Eddie, the Collegiate Sophomore. Copyright 2019 by Dr. Robert E. Z. Chapter 1. School starts, no classes, Part 1. Now that Mr. Crum is gone, life should be much better for the track team at the high school. With McCutcheon and Leggett gone, life should be immensely better at the university as well. Mr. Fraser is looking forward to working with the university team this year, and many of the team members are looking forward to having him as their coach again. Barbara, now a physical education teacher at the high school, is now the school's head track coach. Barbara and her assistant coaches are looking forward to working with Mr. Zunday and the high school team. As the academic year begins at the high school and at the university, peace and quiet is finally realized on all fronts. Over at the high school, following in Mr. Fraser's footsteps, Barbara has orchestrated practice 3 times a week during the autumn. Kathy and Eddie assist with the high school team 1 day a week, primarily helping with the sprinting drills and perfecting the team's relay handoff technique. Mark and Paula also assist 1 day a week, again helping the team in the same way as Kathy and Eddie do. This gives Barbara more time to work with the distance team. On the 3rd day, the team runs the interval training drill, which Barbara can easily handle on her own. In the autumn, Mr. Zunday is working with the football team, so Eddie and Mark are found occasionally working with the field athletes. The field athletes, however, seem to have developed a fierce internal competition among themselves and need minimal coaching and instruction. The core members of the high school track team look strong this year. Barbara has inherited a lot of good talent from Mr. Fraser. Following in his brother's footsteps, Eddie's brother, John, is unquestionably the number one sprinter in the state. Lucius Hill, who is the number one seed in the state in the 440-yard dash and the 880-yard run, is out to break Braden's state record. Whether he will actually do that remains to be seen. And Tom Davidson, the school star distance man, is on track to win the gold medal in the mile at the state invitational meets. Last year, Paul Darvida took the silver medal in the 40-yard dash at the state invitational meet during the indoor track season and in the 100-yard dash at the state invitational meet during the spring track season. The verdict came in and, at both state invitational meets, John won the gold medal, beating out Darvida. If it were not for John, Darvida would have been the number one sprinter in the state. This year, Darvida, who received a full scholarship, will be joining the university team. Amber Amy, Mitchell's longtime girlfriend, will also be joining the university team this year. Also on full scholarship, Amber's primary reason for attending the state university is because Mitchell is there. Amber has already learned through the grapevine that she will be taking Barbara's place in the women's mile medley relay. It's also no secret that Amber will also be running the mile and perhaps the 880-yard run as well. At the university, Johnson is now a junior. Taking a year off before they entered college, Eddie, Mark, Braden, Mitchell, and Bobby B. are all sophomores. Kathy and Paula are now seniors and in their last year of competition. Also, returning to the university team this year is Hoffa, Akinmola, and Erika. Akinmola vows to beat Mitchell in the mile this year during competition. Stone, who is also returning as a senior, does not care if Akinmola beats Mitchell. This year, Stone plans to beat both of them. After all, their new coach, Mr. Fraser, has always said that better internal competition leads to better external competition. At the service station, Angelo now works 5 to 6 hours a day, taking a day or two off every now and then. Eddie has been giving Angelo a lot of stock tips, which have panned out really well. Angelo is now making more money in the stock market than he does by working as a mechanic. Working about 4 hours a day and building dune buggers on the side just for fun, Eddie is doing what he always wanted to do. Tessa's dune buggy is completed, as promised, just in time for the autumn semester. With that project completed, Eddie has more time to work on finishing his own Dune buggy. Mark is busy working as well, along with Bobby B. Eddie's father, Mark's father, and Mark were hired by Dr. Akinmola to build the church building. Mark and Bobby B. will be clearing and grading the land, and doing all of the site preparation work. Eddie's father will begin working shortly on pouring the foundation and erecting the steel skeleton of the building. Once the skeleton is completed, it's onto the concrete walls and floors, brickwork, and roof. Mark's father, with Mark's and Bobby B's help, will then finish the inside of the building. While the inside is being finished, Eddie's father will work on the parking lot and exterior lighting. With the autumn and the first week of classes comes the first session of track practice at the university. By now, the tribe knows the drill well. At 7 a.m., all the athletes are in the arena, either sitting on the bleachers or standing around talking, waiting for the coaching staff to arrive. Sitting along with the tribe this year is Tessa Clement, Amber Amy, and Paul Davida, who will all fit in nicely with the team. Tessa, who has made a special arrangement, will swim for the university during the spring and run track during the winter track season. Also, on the bleachers are several freshmen who sit quietly, taking in all of what is going on. Dr. Braun, the head coach, walks in. He is accompanied by Dr. Paxton, the distance team coach, Coach Herndon, the sprinting team coach, Dr. Bonamo, the field events coach, and Mrs. Owens, the events coordinator. Joining them this year is Mr. George Fraser, who gets a round of applause from the tribe as he walks into the arena. The rest of the coaching staff assumes the applause is for all of them, but Mr. Fraser, looking over at the tribe and seeing them all smile, knows better. Dr. Braun announces, "It's good to see all of you again. I hope you've all had a great summer and managed to find some time to get some training in." As Dr. Braun is introducing the coaching staff, coming to Mr. Fraser, he announces, "Joining us this year is Mr. George Fraser, whom I believe some of you may already know." Applause again breaks out among the tribe, with others joining in. When the applause fades out, Dr. Braun continues, "Mr. Fraser will be working with both the sprinters and distance team, and will be focusing on improving your individual performance." The truth is that Dr. Braun doesn't exactly know what Mr. Fraser will be doing, so he just made that up on the fly. As Dr. Braun is addressing the team, of all people, Todd McCutcheon, with a full head of hair, walks out from the locker room and takes a seat on the bench. Kathy whispers to Eddie, "What is that piece of shit doing here?" Eddie looks over and whispers back, "I guess he wants to get his ass kicked some more." Braden whispers, "That can be arranged. No problem." Also seeing McCutcheon, Paula whispers to Mark, "Oh shit. This is not going to end well." Mark looks over and smiles, whispering to Paula, "I need to stop by the grocery store on the way home and get some more of his shampoo." Last year, Mark mixed a depilatory in with McCutcheon's shampoo, causing him to go bald. McCutcheon never really did understand why his hair started falling out. Walking in after McCutcheon is Dean Grimsby, causing Eddie to laugh out loud. Eddie now clearly knows that Dean Grimsby is not a man of his word. Last season, the Dean assured Eddie that McCutcheon would not be back. But Eddie never trusted Dean Grimsby from the beginning. Eddie can't wait to learn why Dean Grimsby is here today. As the team and the remainder of the coaching staff head out to the track, Dr. Braun and Dean Grimsby stay behind and have a short meeting. Dean Grimsby explains to Dr. Braun that Todd McCutcheon's father has hired an attorney and claims that Todd McCutcheon was expelled from the university without the hearing that he was due. Since the paperwork regarding McCutcheon's expulsion was improperly filed and executed, the university was forced to readmit McCutcheon. What Dean Grimsby does not mention is that the dean, himself, was the one who improperly filed the paperwork. Dr. Braun was also advised that the case involving McCutcheon's breaking and entering charges have been sealed and will not be pursued. Unfortunately, Dean Grimsby advises Dr. Braun that readmission to the university also includes reinstating McCutcheon to his position on the track team. According to Dean Grimsby, the attorney representing Todd McCutcheon also strongly suggested that McCutcheon run in minimally two events, and that the administration supports that position. Dr. Braun listens to Dean Grimsby, superficially agreeing with what he has to say, which is the fastest way to get rid of the dean. Dean Grimsby heads back to his office, confident that McCutcheon will be running in at least two events. Dean Grimsby is also secretly hoping that Eddie does not kick the shit out of McCutcheon, which Eddie once hinted may be on the horizon. Dr. Braun heads out to the track and joins the other coaches, taking less than 3 minutes to dispose of the dean. While Dr. Braun was having his meeting with Dean Grimsby, Braden has made Mr. Fraser aware of the situation last year regarding McCutcheon planting steroids in Eddie's and Mark's lockers. Mr. Fraser has assured Eddie, Mark, and the rest of the tribe that McCutcheon won't be a problem and to just focus on training and winning. The first day of track practice traditionally involves time trials so that the coaches can see where everyone stands and what they have to work with this year. Dr. Braun, knowing that McCutcheon is less than competent as a sprinter, initially assigns him to the distance team. Last year, coaxed by Dean Grimsby, Dr. Paxton expressed interest in having McCutcheon on the distance team. This year, Dr. Paxton, the distance coach, finally gets his wish. And so does Coach Herndon, the sprinting coach, who has absolutely no use for McCutcheon. As the time trials progress, Mr. Fraser is impressed at the skill level of the team he is now part of. On the men's side, Eddie and Mark can easily run the 100-yard dash in the lower 9-second range. Braden, Eddie, Mark, and Johnson can all deliver a 45 to 46-second quarter mile at will. Mitchell, Akinmola, and Stone can all break a 4-minute mile. And Bobby B is still untouched in the shot put, winning every meet last year. Some of the incoming freshmen look strong, reinforcing the overall strength of the team. Among the women, Kathy and Paula have been the best in the division in the short sprints for the last 3 years. With Kathy and Paula graduating this year, the university picked up a few strong female sprinters. Among them is freshman Karen Coy, an excellent sprinter on full scholarship, who is also competitive at the middle distance races. Erica is the best in the division in the 440-yard dash, but Tessa will have something to say about that. Amber Amy will replace Barbara as the woman's distance star and will be running the 880-yard leg in the mile medley relay. At the end of the practice session, Dr. Braun is confident that the team will have as good of a season as last year. Mr. Fraser, on the other hand, is confident that the team can win all the gold medals in the divisional meet, either in the winter or the spring. Making known his high expectations, Mr. Fraser is told by the other coaches not to get his hopes up too high, and that the other teams in the division are highly competent. Mr. Fraser listens to them with his mind, but not with his heart. After practice, the team hits the locker rooms. In the men's locker room, the tribe exchanges high fives, happy that Mr. Fraser is now part of the coaching staff. Looking forward to a winning season, the tribe is more fired up than ever. McCutcheon's enthusiasm seems to be, however, inversely proportional to the tribe's energy. As they head to the showers, Eddie whispers to Mark, "What's up? McCutcheon has hair." Mark replies, "Not for long." As he and Mark are talking, Eddie turns on the shower, quickly noticing that very little water comes out of the shower head. Trying another shower, Eddie finds the same issue. Eddie asks, "And what's up with the showers?" "There's not much water." Mark replies, "Mine's the same way." Hearing the conversation, Mitchell comments, "They must have installed new flow restrictor shower heads over the summer." No one appears to be the least bit happy with the new water-saving shower heads, especially Bobby B, who named them the Waterless Wonders. After the locker room has mostly emptied out, Eddie returns to the showers and removes one shower head, planning to take it home with him. At home, he will re-engineer the shower head, removing any flow-restricting devices, and replace it tomorrow. When everyone else heads to class, Mark and Bobby B. head over to the 7-acre tract of land where Dr. Akinmola's construction project is just getting underway. At the construction site are Mark's and Eddie's fathers, who have just received the building permit and are in the process of siting the building. Mark will begin clearing and grading the land soon. Stone heads home to practice his drums. Since it is rush week at the university, Stone has picked up a few gigs in the evenings and over the weekend. Fraternities and sororities don't pay too well, but the work is nearby. And Eddie heads to the service station to begin his day at work. Mid-morning, at Angelo's service station, Officer Richard Hayes, the police officer investigating Mr. Crumb and the gambling ring, drives in. Knowing when to find Eddie at the station, Officer Hayes plans to stop by occasionally, hoping that Eddie has a few more pieces of the puzzle to share. Seeing Officer Hayes, Eddie recalls a few things he's learned since their last meeting a while ago. Officer Hayes walks up and yells out, "What's up?" Eddie yells back, "What's up?" The proper answer to the question, "What's up?" is always, "What's up?" After Eddie and Richard catch up a bit, Richard asks, "How's the team looking over at the university?" Eddie replies, "We ran time trials today. This year, we're looking really strong. And now that Mr. Fraser is there, the energy level seems to be a whole lot better." Richard asks Eddie, "Do you have any news for me?" Eddie replies, "Oh, yeah. I got some good stuff. Let's go over to the office and sit down." Eddie takes a break and takes a seat with Richard in the office. Richard asks Eddie, "So, what do you got for me?" Eddie explains, "One day last spring, before track practice at the high school, I sat in my car in the parking lot to see what kind of cars some of the teachers drive. It's a good thing you're sitting down." As Eddie is talking, Richard is taking notes. Eddie tells Richard, "Mr. Brian, the social studies teacher, who likes to fail athletes, drives a Mercedes-Benz. So does his son, Jimmy O'Brien, who works at a burger joint downtown." Richard asks, "How old is this Jimmy O'Brien character?" Eddie replies, "He's 19 or 20. Eddie continues, telling Richard, "Mr. Ryan, the baseball coach, drives a Cadillac." Richard asks, "This Mr. Ryan character, isn't he the coach that Crumb left alone?" Eddie replies, "Yeah, that's him. But I still can't figure out how he got a pass." Richard asks, "Is there an assistant baseball coach?" Eddie replies, "No. Whenever we were outside for track practice, Mr. Ryan was the only one out there working with the team." Trying to teach Eddie something, Richard explains, "It would be a whole lot easier to fix a game if he worked alone." Eddie comments, "I can see that." Eddie then tells Richard, "He is the kicker. Mr. Harrison drives a De Tomaso Pantera." Richard's eyes become wide open and asks, "Really? What exactly does this Mr. Harrison do?" Eddie explains, "He's a permanent substitute teacher, which pretty much means he fills in if a teacher has to leave for an emergency during the day. He doesn't really do anything if you ask me." Richard asks, "When did this character pick up the Pantera?" "I don't remember seeing a Pantera at the high school before. A Pantera cannot be missed. Not by Richard, not by Eddie, not by anyone." Eddie replies, "He picked it up during the spring of my senior year. I saw it one day when we were headed out to the track for tryouts. I've never seen it at the high school before that." Richard asks, "Do you have anything else for me?" Eddie replies, "No. Other than McCrutchen is back on the university team again." As Richard is looking through his notes, he tells Eddie, "Refresh my memory. Who is this McCrutchen character again?" Eddie explains, "Actually, his name is Todd McCutchen. He's the guy who planted steroids in my locker and in Mark's locker. He's also the one who runs erratic times and messes up his handoffs. Richard comments, "Oh, that character." Finding what he was searching for in his notes, Richard comments, "McCutcheon. He's the character who runs the quarter mile in 57 seconds 1 week and 75 seconds the next week." Eddie replies, "Yeah, that's the guy." Eddie tells Richard, "I think that's all I have for now." Braden has his eyes on McCutcheon. Well, so does Kathy, Mark, and everyone else. That guy can't be trusted. Richard and Eddie talk for a while longer, but Eddie has to get back to work and Richard has to get rolling. Richard thanks Eddie for the information, confident that he has a few more pieces of the puzzle. Eddie goes back to work, as Richard drives over to the high school to take a closer look at Mr. Harrison's De Tomaso Pantera. A week later, now that each athlete's ability has been adequately assessed, it is time to move on to refining certain skills. Dr. Braun has decided that, now that Mr. Fraser has joined the coaching staff, some formal instruction in the non-visual non-verbal baton exchange the team has been using is in order. The team has informally learned the technique from the tribe. Seeing how well the non-visual non-verbal exchange technique works in competition, Dr. Braun adopted it as the team's preferred technique. Using the 220-yard track in the indoor arena, Mr. Fraser begins formal instruction of the non-visual non-verbal exchange. Using the athletes he has coached for years, demonstrations are made in slow motion and at full speed. And, just so everyone understands, Mr. Fraser clearly explains what is happening at every point during the transition. To prove the efficacy of the technique, Mr. Fraser has the athletes perform several full-speed exchanges. The timekeepers time the period from when the incoming runner enters the transition zone to when the outgoing runner leaves the transition zone. Mrs. Owens records the statistics comparing the non-visual non-verbal exchange with a visual exchange and other techniques. Once the statistics are compiled and presented to the team, everyone is convinced that the non-visual non-verbal technique affords improved performance. Ready to perfect their skill in the non-visual non-verbal technique, the team gets onto the track. Departing from the normal procedure at the university, Mr. Fraser has the men run with the women today. This is to get the runners accustomed to differing speed and skill levels. Using two batons, the drill moves along quickly, with the runners handing off, sprinting for 110 yards, and handing off again. As the coaching staff observes the handoffs, they are looking for a smooth transition. Any slowing of the runner's pace or break in cadence is indicative of a bad handoff. A few minutes into the drill, as the runners are lined up on both sides of the track, Mark does a few calculations in his head about who will be handing off to whom. Mark, near the back of the line, yells out to Eddie, who is second in line, "Yo, Eddie. Come help me out here for a second." Eddie steps out of his position in line, goes to the back of the line, and asks Mark, "What's up, bro?" Mark whispers to Eddie, "Nothing. If you stepped out of line, Braden will be handing off to McCutcheon." Eddie smiles, knowing exactly what Mark is up to. After a few transitions, they see Braden get on the track to receive the baton, and, on the other side of the track, McCutcheon is next in line to receive it. This would usually be called a setup. Braden receives the baton in his right hand, and, as predicted by Mark, at the other side of the track, McCutcheon steps into Braden's lane. Eddie and Mark watch, as Braden moves around the track like a madman. McCutcheon watches Braden approach, and takes off with his right hand behind him. Mark, seeing McCutcheon with his right, instead of left, hand behind him, whispers to Eddie, "Oh shit. Here it comes." As Braden approaches McCutcheon, Braden, using an upsweep motion, jams the baton into McCutcheon's left gluteal region, then shoves him off to the side. McCutcheon goes down hard as Braden steps off the track. As Dr. Braun and Mr. Fraser both blow their whistles, Mark comments to Eddie, "Well, that didn't go exactly as planned." Eddie replies back, yeah, it did, if you're Brayden. Mark whispers to Eddie, you do have a point. Mark knows that, if McCutcheon commits the slightest error, Brayden will cut him absolutely no slack. Eddie mentions to Mark, I think I'll give Brayden one of those Abloy locks for his locker like we have. Eddie and Mark both laugh, having absolutely no sympathy for McCutcheon, who planted steroids in their lockers last year. As McCutcheon is slow to get up, Brayden exclaims, get your fat ass off the floor, Junior. You were supposed to have your left hand out. What is so hard about that? If I have the baton in my right hand, you grab it with your left. I put that baton exactly where I was supposed to. The only problem was your hand wasn't there to grab it. Your ass was. Now, get your lazy ass off the floor and stop crying like a baby. From the other side of the arena, Mark yells out, yeah, Junior. You're holding up the drill. Mark's comment caused a lot of laughter to arise among the athletes. Mr. Fraser has to turn around to conceal his laughter, for he has not heard Brayden this energetic in a while. Coach Herndon yells out, McCutcheon, you heard him. Get up and get back on the track. Mr. Fraser is beginning to understand the dynamics of the university team, which are quite interesting. Mr. Fraser has already heard that McCutcheon is not worth much to the team, and now sees why firsthand. Failing to get any sympathy, McCutcheon finally gets up, limps over, and gets back in line. Mark comments to Eddie, well, that was definitely worth the price of admission. As the drill continues, Mark looks for every chance he can to mess with McCutcheon. But, this time it's Mark's turn. As McCutcheon leaves the transition zone, Mark cuts in front of Eddie and gets on the track. Ready to receive the baton, Mark accelerates as McCutcheon approaches the transition zone. McCutcheon delivers the baton to Mark, who had to slow his pace considerably to receive it. Mark swings his arms a little more than usual, jamming the baton into McCutcheon's hip as he takes off. McCutcheon goes down again, squirming on the ground in pain. Dr. Braun and Mr. Fraser again blow their whistles, stopping the drill. Mark walks around the track, to the other transition zone, where Paula is talking with Erica. Paula whispers to Mark, that was a good takedown. Mark whispers back, thank you. Erica comments, that's twice in one day. Mark laughs and asks, whose turn is it next? Paula then whispers to Mark, did you switch his shampoo yet? Mark replies, no. Not yet. But I'm ready as soon as I get an opening. The rest of practice goes well for everyone, except for McCutcheon, who would have been better off applying to another college. In the locker room, after practice, McCutcheon tells Brayden, don't think I don't know what you're doing. Not taking any of McCutcheon's crap, Brayden exclaims, I ain't doing shit. What you're doing is acting like an asshole, breaking into people's lockers, and planting steroids. What is your problem, Junior? You can't run worth a shit, and you try to take down anyone who can. Why don't you do everyone a favor and just leave now? As McCutcheon listens to Braden's rant, Mark inconspicuously switches McCutcheon's shampoo bottle, which is sitting on the bench, with the special formula Mark prepared a few days ago. Mark then ducks out of sight and hits the showers. And while all the excitement is going on between Brayden and McCutcheon, Eddie reinstalls one of the shower heads that he took home and modified. Using Loctite on the threads, Eddie torques the shower head down with a wrench, using considerable force, ensuring that the shower head cannot be easily removed. Removing another shower head, Eddie will take that one home, modify it, and reinstall it next time, as he has been doing since practice began this year. And Kathy has been removing the water-saving showerheads, one at a time, from the women's locker room, and replacing it with the modified working showerhead the next day. A few days later, Dean Grimsby awaits the arrival of the track team, getting to the arena at 6:30 a.m. As the athletes walk in, they see the dean sitting at the end of the bleachers, alone. His presence can't mean anything good for the team, but no one really seems to care, not even the coaches. By now, everyone knows that Dean Grimsby is pretty much an asshole. Kathy whispers to Eddie, "Dean Grimsby is here. You got busted." Eddie asks, "For what? What did I do?" Mark, adding to the validity of Kathy's claim, adds, "You don't know, bro." Eddie replies, "No. What did I do?" Playing along, Paula tells Eddie, "I'm surprised you don't know." Sounding a bit worried, Eddie asks, "Seriously, guys. What did I do?" Kathy tells Eddie, "You're getting busted for making the showerheads work again." Eddie laughs, knowing that Kathy, along with Mark's and Paula's help, just got him good. Once the team is assembled, Dr. Braun and the coaching staff walk in. Dr. Braun addresses the team, explaining that, today, everyone will be outside running drills and using the training sleds. Interrupting Dr. Braun is Dean Grimsby, who blurts out, "Dr. Braun, I need to speak with your team for a moment, if I may." Dr. Braun, who has had enough of Dean Grimsby after last year's fiasco with McCutcheon and Leggett, tells the dean, "Please don't interrupt me when I am addressing my team. Please explain to Mr. Fraser what you plan to discuss with the team, and I'll get to you as soon as I'm done." Dr. Braun continues addressing the team longer than usual, just to annoy Dean Grimsby. In colleges and universities, certain cliques seem to form among the students. Unknown to most students, cliques also form among the faculty and staff members. After last year, when Dean Grimsby attempted to expel Eddie when steroids were planted in his locker, the entire athletic department has lost all respect for Dean Grimsby. Knowing now that the dean is nothing more than a paper tiger, the coaching staff now messes with Dean Grimsby like Mark messes with McCutcheon. While Dr. Braun is addressing the team, Dean Grimsby explains to Mr. Fraser, "It has come to the university's attention that certain members of the track team are the target of various forms of hazing. Hazing is strictly against the university's rules." Mr. Fraser replies, "I haven't seen any of that. Do you have an example?" Dean Grimsby explains, "Todd McCutcheon has filed a complaint that he has been treated unfairly." Mr. Fraser, fully understanding the complaint, replies, "I can't even begin to imagine what the basis for that complaint was." Mr. Fraser then tells Dean Grimsby, "I'll let him know as soon as he is finished addressing the team. Please have a seat, and we'll get to you in a moment." After addressing the team, seeing Mr. Fraser standing alone, Dr. Braun calls him over and asks, "What does he want, George?" Mr. Fraser reports, "Something about hazing and how McCutcheon is unfairly treated. He wants to address the team." Dr. Braun whispers to Mr. Fraser, "Tell him he has 4 minutes." Waiting to be sure he heard Dr. Braun correctly, Mr. Fraser asks, "4 minutes?" Dr. Braun replies, "Yes, exactly 4 minutes and no more. He's from Babylon." Mr. Fraser, not too familiar with Dean Grimsby, asks, "Why does that matter?" Dr. Braun puts his hand on Mr. Fraser's shoulder and whispers, "George, he's from Babylon. He'll just babble on and babble on unless he's checked. No one around here is going to care what Dean Grimsby has to say anyway. And off the record, the dean is a real ass." Mr. Fraser gets the picture. Dean Grimsby is the Mr. Crumb of the university. Eddie already knew that. Mr. Fraser points to the dean and announces, "You have exactly 4 minutes to address the team." Mr. Fraser then announces, "When he starts talking, will one of the timekeepers please start your watch and tell me when his 4 minutes are up?" All 8 of the timekeepers are quick to get their stopwatches ready to time Dean Grimsby's speech. Mr. Fraser will also time the dean himself. Dean Grimsby stands up and begins arguing with Mr. Fraser. 8 stopwatches are started immediately after the dean utters his first word. The dean argues, "Sir, it is improper protocol to give me a time limit once I have the floor. After all, I'm sure you're aware that I am the dean of students." Mr. Fraser argues, if it is improper to give you a time limit, then I won't give you the floor at all. You can arrange a meeting with the team on your own time. Good luck getting anyone to attend. And I can assure you that I won't be there. Dean Grimsby insists, I will certainly need more than 4 minutes. Throwing one hand into the air, Mr. Fraser raises his voice and exclaims, Mitchell, Akinmola, and Stone can run a mile in 4 minutes. You should be able to say what you have to say in that amount of time. Dr. Braun is impressed with the forthrightness of the new coach. Dean Grimsby argues a little further with Mr. Fraser, but realizes he is hitting a brick wall. Getting absolutely nowhere with Mr. Fraser, Dean Grimsby decides to move on and address the team. Looking at his own stopwatch, Mr. Fraser reminds the dean, since you spent 1 minute and 12 seconds arguing with me, you only have 2 minutes and 48 seconds left. The entire track team laughs, but learns quickly that Mr. Fraser is not one to argue with. Dean Grimsby then begins addressing the team. It has come to my attention that certain team members present here today have been engaged in certain forms of hazing. It is my understanding that one student in particular has been singled out as a target of multiple hazing incidents. The university frowns upon hazing of any type, which can and will result in disciplinary action if the hazing continues. Dean Grimsby likes to hear himself speak, enunciating very slowly, using twice as many words as necessary to convey his thoughts. This is not a good trait to have, since the dean only started out with 4 minutes to state his case. Getting more specific, Dean Grimsby continues, the person who has been the target of multiple acts of hazing is reported to me as being Todd McCutcheon. While I do not want to single out any specific members of the track team as the violators of the university's policy, I'm sure you know who you are. Eddie yells out, what are you talking about? The dean sternly tells Eddie, please don't interrupt me again. Am I clear? Eddie replies, for the record, you're interrupting my track practice. And, for the record, you also told me that Todd McCrutchen was expelled and that he won't ever be back. The dean cannot dispute Eddie, who has just eroded away 20 of his precious seconds. Trying to brush Eddie aside, the dean tells him, I am not prepared to address that issue with you today or with anyone else. If you would like to discuss that issue with me personally, please make an appointment with my office. Eroding away more of the dean's precious time, Eddie sarcastically replies, blah, blah, blah. Mumbo jumbo, mumbo jumbo. Blah, blah, blah. Eddie's frank disrespect of the dean does not go unnoticed. The team and coaching staff laugh hysterically, also eroding away more of the dean's time. Dean Grimsby continues, back to what I was saying. Now, where was I? My mind went blank for a moment after that rude and unexpected interruption. Eddie sarcastically announces, your mind is always blank, Junior. The team laughs, and Dean Grimsby gets quite aggravated at Eddie's comment. Knowing he is under a time constraint, the dean continues, for the information of this team, Scott McCutcheon Sr. gives a considerable sum of money to this university. He is quite upset that his son is being mistreated by certain individuals. This university has a policy regarding. On that unfinished note, 8 timekeepers click their stopwatches and yell out in unison, time's up. Without having to be prompted, the team gets off the bench and heads out to practice. Dean Grimsby gets a bit angry that the coaches and the team did not afford him the attention he thinks he deserves. Dr. Braun does not report to Dean Grimsby, so there is nothing that the dean can do. As the team leaves the arena and heads out to the track, McCutcheon emerges from the locker room, joining the team on their way. Knowing that Dean Grimsby was addressing the team today, McCutcheon keeps his distance. On the way to the track, Eddie asks Dr. Braun, what was Dean Grimsby talking about in there? Dr. Braun, who has about had it with Dean Grimsby, replies, maybe he was referring to people calling him McCrutchen. I don't know. Don't worry about it. Dr. Braun doesn't seem to care about what Dean Grimsby's issue may be. Dr. Braun, in fact, has been pretty much messing with the Dean's head recently, perhaps learning something from Eddie, Mark, or Braden. The Dean has no influence or control over the athletic department anyway, so, unless the so-called hazing was done outside of an athletic team, there's nothing the Dean can do about it. Any hazing that occurs on a sports team would be under the jurisdiction of the university's athletic director, Dr. Karakova. For some reason, no one, including Dean Grimsby, approached Dr. Karakova regarding any alleged hazing issues. It is well known around the university that Dr. Karakova will tell Dean Grimsby to pretty much jump in a lake. While the team is warming up, Kathy mentions to Paula, it looks like McCrutchen is starting to go bald again. Paula informs Kathy, it's prickly sea spiders. It's going to be a tough year for McCrutchen. He won't make it back next year. He's treading on thin ice, and he knows it. Kathy mentions, I wonder why it's so important to him to be on this team anyway. He'd be better off in another university. And what's the deal with Dean Grimsby? He was supposed to expel McCrutchen. Kathy is puzzled at the entire situation surrounding McCrutchen and Dean Grimsby. But Kathy will surely figure it out one way or another. Back at the high school, for once, things are running smoothly. At the end of the school day, Johnson heads over to the high school to visit Mr. Zunday. Walking into the athletic office, Johnson sees that everything looks about the same as it did years ago, except no one is around. Johnson, however, knows exactly where he would find Mr. Zunday. Heading to the weight room, Johnson expects to find Mr. Zunday working with the football players. Walking into the weight room, sure enough, Johnson sees Mr. Zunday putting a few of the football players through a grueling workout. After one football player struggles on the bench with 275 pounds, Johnson sneaks into the rotation while Mr. Zunday is talking with one of the players. Lowering the bar, Johnson benches the weight effortlessly for 10 repetitions. Johnson, of course, attracted a lot of attention with that stunt. Johnson sits up on the bench, and Mr. Zunday exclaims, "Did everyone see that? That is exactly what I expect out of all of you." Johnson asks Mr. Zunday, "So, how's it going?" Mr. Zunday replies, "It's a little quiet around here without Mr. Crum around, but everything is good." Mr. Zunday asks, "How is Mr. Fraser working out at the university?" Johnson explains, "The energy level is a lot better. Dr. Braun, the head coach, doesn't seem to have the energy Mr. Fraser does." Mr. Zunday explains, "Dr. Braun is in very good shape physically, but, you have to remember, he's approaching 70 years old. Johnson replies, "Really? I would have guessed he was in his mid to late 50s. Johnson and Mr. Zunday talk for a while, then Johnson gets around to asking, "Have they found a replacement for Mr. Fraser yet?" Mr. Zunday replies, "No. They haven't even opened the position yet." "Why? Are you interested?" Mr. Zunday saved Johnson the trouble of asking, which is why Johnson came to the high school to talk with Mr. Zunday in the first place. Johnson replies, "Yeah. Actually, I am. But I won't graduate until next year." Mr. Zunday replies, "That's right. Barbara is 2 years ahead of you." Mr. Zunday informs Johnson, "Perhaps Mr. Hess would be open to transferring to the high school. If he does, it would open the position in the middle school. Mr. Hess is likely to retire in 2 years anyway, which would open the position here when you're ready to graduate." Johnson asks, "Do you think they'll go for that?" Mr. Zunday assures Johnson, "We'll get something to work out. Kathy is interested in a position at one of the elementary schools when she graduates. Something will come along." Mr. Zunday has a way of getting things to work out. After all, his cousin, Dr. Noreen Brooks, is the superintendent of schools. Johnson hangs around for a while, helping Mr. Zunday with the football players, and working out himself. As Johnson is working with the athletes, Mr. Zunday can clearly see that Johnson would be a good asset to the physical education staff. And in the hiring process, it is always better to go with someone who is known to be competent than someone who is an unknown. During the training session, Mr. Zunday speculates on the various options available to get Johnson hired as a physical education instructor. Although Johnson did not mention it, Mr. Zunday suspects that Johnson would also like to coach the track team along with Barbara. Mrs. Black, Jimmy O'Brien, and Mr. Crum all seem to look down at Eddie because he is a mechanic. About a year ago, Chuck's mother, Mrs. Black, commented to Eddie, "Is that all you turned out to be? Just a mechanic?" Mr. Crum did not want Eddie working on his car simply because he is Eddie. And last summer, Jimmy O'Brien snickered at Eddie and asked him, "So, is that all you're doing now? Pumping gas?" Not everyone, however, is disappointed that Eddie has chosen to be a mechanic. It's what he always wanted to do, and he's good at it, just as Angelo is good at it. As Mr. Zunday is driving to work one day, he hears an unusual sound coming from the engine of his Porsche 911. Instead of turning left into the school parking lot, he continues on and heads to Angelo's service station. Unlike Mr. Crum, Mr. Zunday takes care of problems when they arise, not waiting for further damage to occur. Unfortunately, the sound gets a little worse as Mr. Zunday drives toward the service station. Hearing the Porsche 911 as Mr. Zunday drives in front of a service bay, Eddie immediately runs outside, sticks his hand through the window, and turns off the engine. Eddie tells Mr. Zunday, "You're about to lose your engine. It sounds like a bearing is ready to go." Eddie knows that sound really well. He's heard it many times before. Mr. Zunday explains, "It was running fine when I left for work, but when I got near the school, it was beginning to sound a little rough." Eddie informs Mr. Zunday, "It's either a connecting rod bearing or a main bearing." Mr. Zunday tells Eddie, "Break it down and find out what's going on. Whatever it is, go ahead and fix it. If there's a problem with the engine, Mr. Zunday wants it fixed." Eddie writes up the service ticket and gives Mr. Zunday a ride back to the high school. Just before the end of the school day, Eddie drives over to the high school to pick up Mr. Zunday. On the way back to the service station, Eddie explains, "One of the bolts to the main bearings backed off a bit. I replaced the bearing and checked the torque of all the other bolts inside. Everything else looked okay." Mr. Zunday replies, "Good. But I'm wondering why that happened." Eddie asks, "Has the engine ever been opened up before?" Mr. Zunday replies, "Not as far as I know." Eddie explains, "It could just be a fluke. But everything's torqued correctly now." When they arrive back at the service station, Mr. Zunday pays for his repair, not complaining as Mr. Crum always does. Eddie introduces Mr. Zunday to Angelo, who have both heard a lot about each other. Finally getting to meet, Angelo and Mr. Zunday talk for a while as Eddie heads home. Eddie went out of his way and worked overtime to fix Mr. Zunday's engine. Needless to say, Mr. Zunday will be taking his Porsche 911 to Eddie for service now. Track practice has become a bit interesting for the tribe after Dean Grimsby admonished the team for the alleged hazing of McCutcheon. During the relay practices, any baton exchanged to or from McCutcheon seems to fail miserably. The baton is transferred outside the transition zone, not transferred at all, lands on the ground, or is accidentally shoved into McCutcheon's gluteal region. The rest of the team, for some miraculous reason, has tremendously improved their baton handoff performance. McCutcheon has again gone completely bald. The doctors are blaming it on stress and suggested that he take vitamins. Stress is common in college, where students have a full academic and social schedule. Being a collegiate athlete can easily add to the stress. The only stress, however, that McCutcheon can identify is the stress caused to him by the track team. McCutcheon is hopeful, though, that the vitamins will not only cause his hair to grow back, but will also improve his performance on the track. As the team is getting dressed for practice, pointing out the obvious, Mark yells out to McCutcheon, "Yo, Junior. It looks like you're bald again. It's the prickly sea spider bite." Brushing off Mark's comment, McCutcheon insists, "The doctors said it's stress. They gave me some vitamins, and my hair will grow back soon." Mark replies, "Yeah. It's stress all right. Your adrenal glands are all shriveled up. You can't handle stress anymore." McCutcheon never learns, for he should have ignored Mark. Sounding very authoritative, Mark then instructs McCutcheon, "Yeah, go ahead and take the vitamins, Junior. The vitamins are going to liquefy your brain." McCutcheon replies, "They will not." Overhearing the conversation, Eddie, attempting to conceal his laughter, pretends to cough. Listening in, as Mark is messing with McCutcheon, is Mitchell, who is ticked off now that McCutcheon is on the distance team. Mitchell chimes in and tells McCutcheon, "Mark is right. The B vitamins react with the prickotoxins and form ganglioacetic acid. Ganglioacetic acid will slowly eat away at your white matter. You really should listen to Mark. He's been right all along, and your doctors haven't even seen it." Not missing a beat, Mark tells McCutcheon, "See? What did I tell you? Do you think I just make this shit up?" McCutcheon begins to look worried. After all, Mitchell is perhaps the most intelligent guy on the track team. What Mitchell said sounds very convincing to McCutcheon, even though it's totally fabricated. Before they head out to the track, Eddie pulls Braden aside, telling him, "I got something for you, bro." Braden asks, "What's that?" Eddie replies, "A lock for your locker." Braden tells Eddie, "I already got one of those." Eddie explains, "This lock is pick-proof. I'm guessing that you're next on McCutcheon's list. This will keep him out of your locker." Eddie hands Braden the Abloy PL362 padlock, which he obtained from going into the future. Looking at the lock, Braden tells Eddie, "I ain't never seen a lock like this before." Evading further questioning, Eddie replies, "They are really hard to find." Braden then whispers to Eddie, "This is kind of a secret. After McCutcheon broke into Mark's locker, we had a silent alarm system installed in this building. If anyone breaks in, the alarm goes off down at the station." Eddie tells Braden, "Use the lock anyway, bro. He can still sneak into the locker room during the day or while we're practicing. And you never know. Lugnut could have shown him how to pick a lock." Braden replies, "That's a good point." Braden takes the lock, thanking Eddie for looking out for him. Dr. Paxton, the distance coach, has displayed a lot of patience working with McCutcheon this season. Mitchell, however, would be glad to get rid of McCutcheon and is doing his part to help. The 4x880 relay team is bound to take nothing this year with McCutcheon in the lineup. Akinmola, Stone, and Johnson are not too happy with McCutcheon either. One of them will likely get bumped from the 4x880 relay team in favor of McCutcheon per administrative decree by Dean Grimsby. After practice, McCutcheon tries to gain the upper hand, starting his own psychological warfare. As Eddie opens his locker, McCutcheon asks him, "How come you and Mark never go to class?" Eddie replies, "What are you talking about, Junior? Last semester, I got all A's. So, just shut up and mind your own business. That is, if you have any business." Eddie doesn't know what McCutcheon is up to, but he doesn't like it. McCutcheon tries to continue the conversation, but Eddie has had enough of him. Eddie firmly tells McCutcheon, "I said shut up, Junior. And remember the Chucky." Eddie and Mark leave the locker room, noticing that McCutcheon is following them at a safe distance. Eddie whispers to Mark, "McCutcheon might be onto us. Let's head toward the classrooms." As they are walking, Eddie, seeing a girl who is walking and carrying books, whispers to Mark, "Hey, follow her. She looks like she's going to class." Eddie made a good choice. Neither he nor Mark even know exactly where the classrooms are. With McCutcheon following, Eddie and Mark follow the girl into a lecture hall and take a seat in the back. McCutcheon sneaks into the lecture hall, wondering what kind of classes Eddie and Mark are taking. Taking a seat at the other side of the lecture hall, McCutcheon hides behind a few students and decides to briefly stay for the lecture. It's not that McCutcheon cares about what is being taught today. It's that he's been watching Mark, Eddie, Bobby B., and a few others very closely, wondering when they go to class. After all, after track practice, Eddie, Mark, and Bobby B. always head out in their vehicles, and they are never seen with any books. The professor, Dr. Bonnie Bancroft, walks in and, after making a few announcements, announces, "As promised, Dr. Erin Chandler will be our guest lecturer today. Please give her a warm welcome." The class applauds as Dr. Chandler walks up to the front of the class. Eddie whispers to Mark, "I wonder what class we're taking." Mark replies, "I guess we're about to find out." Eddie whispers to Mark, "I'm sure glad there's not a test today." Mark whispers back, "You got that right." After a brief introduction, Dr. Chandler begins, "Today, as promised, we are going to analyze the harmonic characteristics found in a female soprano voice responsible for giving it pleasant tonal characteristics. As you all probably know, C4 is known as middle C. The range of a soprano is from C4 to C6 or, for you technically minded people, from about 262 Hz to 1047 Hz. But, just what is it that makes the voice of Joan Baez or Crystal Gayle pleasing to listen to when compared with other sopranos whose voice may screech at times? Before we discover why one soprano voice sounds pleasant, whereas another does not, let us first look at the differences in the harmonic distortion characteristics of a tube versus a transistorized amplifier." Eddie whispers to Mark, "I think we are in a music class." Mark, who turned toward Eddie as Eddie whispered to him, replies, "Don't look now, but McCutcheon is at the other end of the row looking at us." Eddie whispers back, "Are you for real?" Mark replies, "Yeah. He must have followed us into the classroom." Eddie whispers, "I guess we're staying for the whole class then." Mark whispers, "I wonder what his problem is." Eddie replies, "The tribe." Putting up an image on the overhead, Dr. Chandler explains, "If we look at the harmonic distortion curve of a transistor power amplifier, we clearly see that harmonic distortion is very pronounced in the odd harmonics when compared with the even harmonics." Switching to another image, Dr. Chandler continues, "In the vacuum tube amplifier, however, we observe quite the opposite. Harmonic distortion is very pronounced in the even harmonics when compared with the odd harmonics." This, by the way, is exactly why a tube amplifier has a characteristically warmer sound than does a transistor amplifier. The harmonic distortion of a tube amplifier is primarily found in the even, not the odd, harmonics. Harmonic distortion, particularly when present in the even harmonics, is natural and generally not objectionable. Harmonic distortion, when present in the odd harmonics, is, in contrast, quite objectionable. Dr. Chandler continues, "As a side note, what is also objectionable is something called transient intermodulation distortion. Transient intermodulation distortion is caused purely by a deficient slew rate of the amplifier. The slew rate is how fast the amplifier can respond to the incoming signal. If the amplifier cannot respond to the incoming signal fast enough, the result is a very unnatural and objectionable distortion." Again, for you technically minded people, transient intermodulation distortion results from the incoming sine wave exiting the power transistor in not quite a sinusoidal pattern. So, the incoming sine wave exits the amplifier as something other than a sine wave. The human voice, by the way, does not and cannot exhibit any of the characteristics of transient intermodulation distortion. Dr. Chandler then informs the students, "Since all of you are college students, I'll mention this. When you go to purchase a stereo amplifier, the manufacturer always quotes the performance characteristics of the amplifier in their literature, such as the output power, frequency response, harmonic distortion, etc. All manufacturers intentionally leave out the one meaningful performance measurement, which is the slew rate. It's what they don't tell you that matters. I'll let all of you speculate why that is." Eddie mentions to Mark, "This might be interesting." Mark comments, "Yeah. I hope I can understand it." Eddie replies, "Me too. She sounds like a genius." Mark comments, "That's probably because she is one." Eddie is now wondering if he is in a music class or some sort of engineering class, since the lecturer is now talking about audio amplifiers. Putting up a frequency spectrograph on the overhead, Dr. Chandler continues, "This is a spectrum analysis of the voice of Joan Baez. As we can clearly see, there is considerable energy in the lower even harmonics, and very little energy in the upper even harmonics. Also, what we observe is that there is very little energy in the odd harmonics, either above or below the fundamental frequency. We also observe that the spectrograph shown is characteristically similar to a tube amplifier versus a transistor amplifier. Is everyone with me so far? Or have I lost everyone?" Eddie raises his hand, and Dr. Chandler points to and addresses Eddie, "Yes, sir, in the back. Do you have a question?" Eddie replies, "Yes. How about the tonal characteristics of Stevie Nicks' voice? Where would that fit in? It seems that her voice is quite unique." Dr. Chandler replies, "Actually, that is an excellent question. Stevie Nicks is a mezzo-soprano, but she has a considerable amount of power in the lower second harmonic. And, get this. This is where it gets very interesting. Stevie Nicks, oddly, has a notable amount of power in the upper first harmonic, but not the upper even harmonics. A voice with the tonal characteristics such as that of Stevie Nicks is quite rare, which is why her voice is so unique. Interestingly, Stevie Nicks is often mistaken as a contralto. The mistake is commonly made by the untrained ear because of the significant amount of power present in the lower second harmonic. But frequency spectrum analyzers do not lie." That was a very good question. I hope I answered it to your satisfaction. Eddie gives the guest lecturer a thumbs up. As a few other students ask questions, Eddie glances over, seeing McCutcheon at the end of the row. McCutcheon inadvertently makes eye contact with Eddie. Eddie, sounding like a genius by asking a simple question, has now clearly gained the upper hand, especially since McCutcheon likely has not understood a word Dr. Chandler has said thus far. Eddie and Mark stay for the rest of the class, finding it quite interesting. McCutcheon also stays and cannot sneak out now that he has been discovered. When class is dismissed, Mark tells Eddie, "I need to get to the door before McCutcheon." Eddie and Mark bolt toward the door, hanging out outside the lecture hall, waiting for McCutcheon to leave. Seeing McCutcheon as he walks out, Mark asks McCutcheon, "Hey, do you have the notes from the last class? We missed it." McCutcheon, knowing that he just got busted by Mark, brashly replies, "No." Eddie comments, "I didn't know McCutcheon was in our class." Mark replies, "Me neither. You'd think he'd help us out, since we missed the last class, but no. He never was a team player anyway." McCutcheon, who is dumbfounded, cannot even find the words to respond to Mark. Mark tells Eddie, "We'll just get the notes from someone else." Continuing the conversation, Mark asks McCutcheon, "So, do you have class?" McCutcheon replies, "No." Mark replies, "I didn't think so." Mark's play on words fly right over McCutcheon's head. Referring to McCutcheon, Mark tells Eddie, "This guy is such a loser." Mark and Eddie follow the crowd to somewhere else on campus. McCutcheon, who is done with classes until the afternoon, dare not follow them this time. The next week, after a practice session, Coach Herndon asks Dr. Braun and Mr. Fraser to remain after practice for a moment. Coach Herndon asks them to step into an office adjacent to the arena so that they may have some privacy. Dr. Braun, Coach Herndon, and Mr. Fraser walk into the nicely appointed office with a glass window overlooking the arena, which is usually reserved for the officials during a meet. Dr. Braun asks Coach Herndon, "What's up?" Coach Herndon, who always gets right to the point, replies, "I am requesting permission to resign from my position with the team, sir." Dr. Braun pauses and responds, "This is certainly a surprise. Is there something wrong?" Coach Herndon replies, "No, sir. Not at all. I signed on for the position 6 years ago when Coach Jensen retired, primarily because, at the time, I needed the money. Over the years, I've really enjoyed working with the team as the sprinting coach. With all due respect, sir, now that Mr. Fraser has joined the coaching staff, I feel that I can move on without adversely affecting the team." Mr. Fraser tells Coach Herndon, "Please don't feel like you have to resign because I'm now here." Coach Herndon replies, "It's not that, sir. Not at all. I took this position temporarily when Coach Jensen retired. I never expected for my assignment to last this long. Now that you're here, I know that the sprinting team will be in good hands." Dr. Braun, focusing his attention to Mr. Fraser, adds, "George, this is my failure. I was supposed to find someone to replace Coach Jensen as the sprinting coach years ago. Coach Herndon has been doing such a great job that I was very slow to find Coach Jensen's replacement. After a while, I just forgot about it." Coach Herndon tells Dr. Braun, "From what I hear from Provost Layton, there is no one more qualified in the division or in the state to be the sprinting coach than Mr. Fraser. The team will certainly be in good hands." Dr. Braun tells Coach Herndon, 6 years is certainly a long time for a temporary assignment. I can see your point. If you really want to resign, I'll accept your resignation. I certainly appreciate all the work you've put in over the years. You've always gone above and beyond your call, which has not gone unnoticed." Coach Herndon replies, "Thank you, sir. I've really enjoyed working with the team, but it's time for me to move on and focus more on the university's ROTC program." Dr. Braun tells Coach Herndon, "Okay, I'll accept your resignation. And I'll let you determine your effective resignation date. But I can assure you that you'll be missed by all of us." Coach Herndon explains, "I'd prefer that my resignation be effective immediately to allow the team to adjust to working with Mr. Fraser before the season begins. It would be in the best interest of the team." Coach Herndon sincerely has the team's best interests at heart. But, as she said, it is time for her to move on. Dr. Braun, who understands, tells Coach Herndon, "Well, if there is no objection from Mr. Fraser, I'll accept your resignation effective immediately." Mr. Fraser does not object, and it is decided that Coach Herndon will be released from her duties. On their way out, Coach Herndon mentions, "You know, I'm really going to miss Axel Braden." Mr. Fraser comments, "He's one of the best athletes that I've ever coached." Coach Herndon tells Mr. Fraser, "Of all the athletes that have come through this university that I've had the pleasure to meet, Axel Braden is, by far, my favorite." Braden is probably Coach Herndon's favorite because of his military personality, his pre-race rants, and the running cadences he had the team chant last year. Quite often, Braden also spared Coach Herndon the pain of dealing with McCutcheon. Mr. Fraser reminds Coach Herndon, "You can still come to the meets and watch. I'm sure the team will be glad to have you present." Dr. Braun adds, telling Coach Herndon, "I think we can arrange for you to be where the action is if you'd like." Coach Herndon replies, "Thank you, sir. I might just take you up on that." Knowing that the sprinting team is now under expert guidance, Coach Herndon can now move on. After practice every day, Mark and Bobby B, head over to the 7-acre tract of land where Dr. Akinmola is building a church building. Eddie's father and Mark's father have been working on the project from sunrise to sunset. The project is moving along quickly, and Mark and Bobby B. have been glad to pick up the extra work. Paula takes the money Mark earns and takes it to the bank. Taking the money to the bank, to Paula, means buying gold, taking the gold to the future, selling it, and bringing home a huge profit. And Bobby B. has been investing in the stock market, per Eddie's stock recommendations.